The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Back again. It's Friday, the end of one of the most tumultuous weeks in modern American history, without a question. And I hope all of you are feeling a little relieved. I think even the losers have to feel relieved. We're probably all subjects of PTSD to some degree. This has been a tremendous grind. We're going to change gears tonight, set a course this evening that's going to take you mentally into new areas, unexplored areas, areas that we have been trying through the good graces of Frank Chile and, of course, William Tompkins to bring you here first. We call it disclosure, among other things. It has to do with UFOs. It has to do with off-planet intelligence. It has to do with Germany in World War II and the absolute brilliance of their scientists and what they successfully developed, and what happened to that after the war. We also want to remember that William Tompkins, young Bill, was involved during the war with debriefing spies, operatives, Americans of German heritage who spoke fluent German, who volunteered to be sent to Germany during the war to try to find out what was going on there. And the material they brought back verbally, perhaps in some cases in papers, but mostly things that they had seen, were disclosed in the North Island Naval Station San Diego debriefings that Bill Tompkins was privileged to be a key player. There were only a handful of people there at the most. Admiral Rico Botta and Bill Tompkins, the names that most of you will remember. Bill is back with us tonight. We're going to talk about a lot of things that have never been talked about before. He says his second book is moving along, and we want to say hello to Bill. Hi, friend. How are you?
Hi, Jeff. What's up for tonight?
Well, that's the $64 question, and you have the key to that door. So we'll find out when we get there. Here's what I want to do. I got some copies from Frank that you sent to him. Douglas Aircraft Internal Documents. And I've been able to look at them in a cursory fashion, at least. You know what I'm talking about. And apparently you have...
Oh, my gosh. That's interesting stuff.
It's fascinating. Now, what I'm talking about here are documents from Douglas Aircraft, which became McDonnell Douglas Missiles in Space later on. But these are from the 1955 era. And Bill Tompkins was involved with Douglas, as you probably know, during that period of time and thereafter, and then TRW, Thompson Ramo Wooldridge. And why I mention these two, and I think if you were with us before, you'll know that Douglas Aircraft and TRW were involved in the most advanced research that you could imagine. It sounds like science fiction. So what I got was a small portion of some of the documentation that Bill Tompkins, and I won't even ask him where or how he got them, because these are clearly, although they're not stamped classified, they would be considered classified data without any question. Anything you want to tell us about these pieces of paper in general, Bill? Don't tell me how you got them, but they do reflect a lot of your work because you were involved with this stuff.
Absolutely. But we have to go back again for a few minutes with those nice Navy operatives in 1942,
right,
coming back from Germany, because it was necessary for us to take their information that they bought and put it into technical packages and then disseminate it to universities and secret organizations in the Navy.
Which you did.
Contractors.
Yeah.
Which I did. Now, once again, this information was so classified at the highest level of anything in the country, okay?
Right.
Nothing was more secret than this. But every document, every piece of paper that we took to put together as, they called them packages, but they were proposals,
mm-hmm,
to JPL or Caltech or Northrop or Lockheed, whatever, nothing was stamped even confidential. It was so classified, nothing was stamped as secret.
How interesting.
And
that's why these pages had no classification on them, because they were above classification.
And so what you're looking at there, one of them was a document to Elmer Wheaton, who's vice president of engineering, from Dr. Klemper, who's the guy that was running the secret think tank inside of Douglas. Even engineering, the secret programs in engineering, didn't even know that existed in Douglas.
All compartmentalized. Was Dr. Klemper a German?
Yes, he was, but he was not an SS, because he came here in the late 40s, or in the late 30s.
Ah, so before the war.
Mm-hmm. Way before the war, had nothing to do with
paperclip.
The SS.
Yeah.
And, or even paperclip. That's correct. So he volunteered his technical experience that he had in Germany to Douglas, which was really good. And so he ended up being the head guy, if you want to call it, of this secret think tank inside of Douglas. And so there's one of the documents that it's called Unconventional Propulsion Schemes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
What in the world is that all about? Well, yes, it is all about completely different types of propulsion for different types of space vehicles. And so, yes, anti-gravitational propulsion is in there, and anti-gravitational is in there, but you would not believe how many other types of unconventional propulsion the Germans were working on.
Yeah, yeah.
And that particular document covers this. Go ahead.
It's fascinating, and I'm going to read just a little bit to our listeners to give them an idea. This is 1955, March the 1st, from W.B. Klemperer to Elmer Wheaton, the director of this top-secret, ultra-secret program, having to do with subject unconventional propulsion schemes. They called them schemes, ideas, concepts. Let me read just a little bit of this here. Our studies of the possible merits or significances of occasionally appearing publications concerning unconventional propulsion schemes have been casually continued since writing the first memorandum about their progress to mid-December 1954. Between that time and the end of February 1955, 20 more papers on pertinent topics have been obtained and read. They are reviewed in the appended Astronautical Literature Review pages, serial number 026 to 045. The content of most of them falls into similar categories as those reviewed before. Several more occasions were had to talk personally to people about the subject. Two of such interviews are abstracted, one with Dr. C.B. Milliken and the other with Captain W.T. Sperry of American Airlines, who encountered a UFO in flight in 1950. We also have looked at a few typical flying saucer books, but found none of them to be of technical significance thus far. So right away there, in 1955, we have a formal, above top secret admission that UFOs are being observed in flight by very credible and highly professional people, such as a captain of an American Airlines flight. Now, let me jump ahead, Bill, if you don't mind me reading just a little bit more here. I'm going to read this as it sits. Dr. Hershberger, professor of applied electromagnetic theory and related subjects in engineering, was interviewed at some length as he was quite interested in the subject and appeared to have been exposed to some of the proposals involving electrical forces and particularly that of ionic propulsion. This is 1955, ladies and gentlemen. He too expressed himself as skeptical as to the chances of early exploitation of any of the proposed schemes, but he was quite ready to concede that one should study such proposals with an open mind and review their critique as suitable time intervals as the knowledge of fundamental principles, we're talking about physics here, and the art of their applications expand. And one more here. Dr. Tribus, is it Tribus? T-R-I-B-U-S? I guess it is.
Yes.
Professor of heat transfer in engineering, again, this is physics, 1955, has also been seeing articles on our subject. As a practical engineer, he was much impressed by the seriousness of the requirements of enormous surfaces for the cold junctions or condensers of any thermal cycle engine in space. Thermal cycle engine in space. This is before we had the first satellite in orbit by a couple of years. And of the vast structural and plumbing requirements usually dealt with disdain or negligence by the proponents of most of the schemes. Dr. Tribus suggested several other UCLA scientists, such as Dr. Thomas E. Hicks and Dr. Robert Bromberg, the latter presently on leave while with Remo Woolridge, might have something pertinent to contribute. Just amazing, Bill.
It really is.
This, when I read this, what did it do to your mind, Bill? How did it take you back to these days? What are your thoughts when we talk about ionic and electrical propulsion and outer space thermal cycle engines? This is wild stuff, and this is 1955.
Yes, it is. And as I read this with you here, I get the chills, because you have to realize that what you're reading there is some of the things that U.S. Navy operatives brought back from Germany. Oh my gosh. In 1942, this is unreal. And so you're on through this document, you're going to read specific German mm-hmm. proposals for propulsion.
Right.
And you're going to see all these other people who have ideas, and they're triggered from so many pilots seeing extraterrestrial vehicles here in the United States.
And some of them are not extraterrestrial, are they? No, they're terrestrial.
That's right.
Like German. Like what flew over the White House in 1951 in that squadron. Okay?
Those were German.
Yeah.
Those were German from Antarctica.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
They were making a statement, and they certainly did it. I had someone on the program here once who was a radar operator that night and described the whole thing, what he saw, not only outside but on his screen. And it was more than real. That must have shaken up a lot of people in the Pentagon and other places, I would think.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, so when you have provided this, this short group of documents to Frank. He's got more, I guess. Some were sent to me. These documents not only substantiate your experiences, your stories, what you went through, but they actually give all of us an inside look. We're talking about ionic propulsion discussions for space vehicles in the early 1950s. This is really remarkable. People wouldn't believe it before the first satellite went up.
It's it does sound unreal, but you have to try to visualize what all these people were doing and thinking. Like I mentioned, I think before, I have a chart on the wall here in my office, mm-hmm. and it's called Technical Progress Versus Time. And it starts, 10,000 years ago.
Technical progress versus time. It's a timeline. Okay.
Yeah, and it goes from 30,000 years ago up to, 1980. And it only raises about a half a degree all the way across that time period. And then this chart goes almost straight up, like 99 degrees. And this is a technical explosion on our planet. Of information that the public doesn't have a feel of what's happened here. And you have to ask yourself the question, mm-hmm. how did all these people get so involved in this? Wow.
And what you have to ask yourself the other question, as a species, what triggered this astonishing leap forward in technology? And then you would probably want to suggest to yourself that, well, maybe there was some outside influence in some of it. Yes?
A lot more than some of it, like 90%. So you have pilots flying Navy aircraft or even Air Force, and they see UFOs. Nobody accepts this, but this is what the pilots have to report. Uh-huh. They have to write up a report on that sighting. The Navy has to do the same thing. And so this information is like unreal. Nobody knows how to handle the information. Nobody knows what approaches can be used. So the particular document that you're looking at, unconventional propulsion schemes, they call it, mm-hmm. They don't call it, they're schemes trying to figure out what is really going on.
Oh, that's fascinating, Bill. They didn't call them systems because it was really out of their mental envelope. They were in uncharted territory, so they called them schemes because to them they were kind of cockeyed and cuckoo, and this is weird stuff, so they called them schemes. I get it. And we're talking about propulsion systems. Free radical chemistry, metastable states, composite types of propulsion, air-jacketed rockets, non-propulsive supporting force metals, and energy beams, and ionic propulsion, as I mentioned earlier. Just a few of the things that were being heavily looked at in the early 1950s that didn't come from Homo sapiens, okay? We were seeded with information given tremendous, a huge advantage over normal evolution in mental prowess and the idea of a species creating something in a field that had never been looked at before. And all of a sudden, as you say, the knowledge base goes straight up. That's amazing.
They even have, like authors of high school teachers who one of the students told the class that their dad, who was a commercial pilot flying commercial airplanes, saw a UFO. So the son then is given permission in that class to let the class let him read the information that he got from his dad in class, so that this got into high schools. It even got into grade schools. But all of this, like you've said, just happened like in a microscopic period of time, just a grain of sand, a period of space-time. And so, yes, most of this came from extraterrestrials to us. To the people on this planet.
Yeah, and if anyone is listening with a truly objective mind, you'll have to admit that what Bill just described is the only way to analyze this. This incredible leap forward that began in the 1950s was made possible through off-planet intervention, assistance. We were seeded with that knowledge somehow. Our physicists who came across this must have been just mind-boggled by some of it.
Absolutely correct. And the diversification of the different approaches, like you said, is almost unreal. But you have to remember, these people were tremendously influenced by information that somehow got in their head. And so they hear this thing, they feel this information, and they themselves personally then demand to know some way of accomplishing this.
And what you just said, I don't want to pass by too quickly. You said information that somehow got into their head. All right, we're talking telepathic information exchange, dissemination from off-planet. I mean, certainly we were being visited, but the means by which it was disseminated and implanted in the human psyche, the intellect, was telepathic, correct?
Absolutely, yes. And far more people were given different information than most of the public has any idea. And yes, Germany got the deal with the reptilians, and so yes, they got nice brand new UFOs to copy. But you have to accept that different extraterrestrials from the reptilians, say the Nordic people, who essentially were sort of influencing us, essentially trying to get us to accomplish like the Apollo program. And so what you really have is that the Apollo program itself was to orientate the United States to be the primary people to penetrate out into the galaxy at request by the Nordic people. So all of these different informations on propulsion, all the different types, were sort of paralleled with that mission. And most of the people received information telepathically. And I agree that a lot of people say that's not really true, that's not it. But believe me, I'm not exaggerating. Information got into each one of these fellows in that unconventional propulsion scheme program to get an idea presented and run with the ball. And so, yes, they're being influenced. Yes, somebody wanted them to do something. The Nordics wanted the public on this planet to join them in the galaxy. And we didn't get to do it because of a lot of problems we've talked about before.
Yes.
But you have to go back to each one of the people in this document and realize there are tremendously influenced and interested in trying to accomplish this in whatever means possible. So that's the reason there's so many approaches. And yes, Douglas did ask the questions of the highest technical people in different universities all across the country to review information, ask them what they thought it could be, and in attempting to sort of disseminate the information to try to come up with other alternatives, other methods, or whatever could be come up with to accomplish it. It's crazy.
Some of the vectors of this information probably, I'm going to guess here, would involve some of these gorgeous Nordic secretaries who just happen to be working at Douglas and other places. Is it fulfilling a kind of a normal office support role? But in reality, were they potentially the vectors for a lot of this data?
Absolutely. Actually, there were three young people, two young, really nice-looking young men. He wasn't there all the time, but he was sort of assisting the two young ladies.
Mm-hmm.
And so the information with both of them was, again, like in my particular situation, dropped into my head at night. Dropped into my head at a meeting with the 18 or 20 people in the conference room. She's back at her desk, not in engineering,
mm-hmm.
and I'm in a conference room half a block away. And she would drop the information into my head of the major problems with a unbelievable answer. And I'm talking not just our end, our problems here, but NASA's problems, the major problems. And she would drop into my head exactly what needs to be said, and it fixed it, essentially. Now, I got credit for it, but I'm saying that a great deal of the accomplishments that we were able to do with this small group of engineering designers in the Apollo program that I was section chief of, these people were also being given information like in this unconventional propulsion scheme document you've got, to address it in a different way than is normal. And it's hard for everybody to realize that extraterrestrials are a whole lot smarter than we are on this planet, smarter than the brilliant Germans, smarter than all of the technical people and all of the books that are written on engineering, astronomy, mathematics, you name it. This information, two things. One, it is given to us as a control, preventing us to understand what's really going on, by reptilian extraterrestrials. The other part is coming, dropped into our heads by Nordic-type people who are attempting to give us the capability of technically operating not just from a military standpoint, but from a commercial standpoint out in the galaxy. Commerce with other stars, intelligent people.
So Bill, what you're saying is that the reptilians were trying to rein this in, keep a cap on what the Nordics were giving us. There was a push and a pull going on here. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yes, and also that virtually every school book, from as far as you want to go back in history, is a group of not untruth, lies, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So astronomers have been taught incorrect information. The physicists have been taught incorrect information.
By the reptilians?
By the reptilians. And so this
misdirection.
Program, this
I got it. They were pushing them off into... Yeah, okay.
It has been going for thousands of years.
Uh-huh.
And so when something like this document you're reading mm-hmm. comes along, mm-hmm. Every one of these people jump on it because they realize then that they have been given incorrect information in engineering. And that here's what's really going on. let's take the ball and run with this one.
They were chasing their tails. They were chasing their tails.
But the enthusiasm, you're reading it here. The enthusiasm these people went into this were pinned up with incorrect information, everything they'd learned for the 6 years in the university.
Uh-huh.
And now they're starting to realize that what they have learned is incorrect. They have something here. It's totally is opposite of what they've been taught. I'm saying astronomers too. They've had the wrong information purposely given to them. So these fellows you're reading in here, actually, this is important. These fellows took every possible idea, started to write it down, look at it, come up with a method of doing it. They call it, they call it schemes. Sort of like, sort of like the Navy operatives bringing information back from Germany. And then North Island, a little group that were working with, trying to come up with, a proposal that, say is communication or whatever. And then I have to drive it or fly it over to one of the aircraft companies and give it to them.
Uh-huh.
And so we called it, they called it. There were packages. These guys call it schemes. Do you see what I'm saying?
Schemes.
It's like,
that's a very interesting word, because it connotes a disbelief, they're almost mocking it with great respect. A scheme. It's not science. It's not a system. It's a scheme.
It's not normal science.
That's right.
It's not normal science.
Got it.
And they don't approach it as normal science.
Yeah. Well, they had to step into an area that they had never been in before. This must have been, as you did say, so exciting for them. They must have been just over the top with a drive to learn. I want to ask another question, though. Let's say the reptilians were out of the picture. You got the Nordics. They're feeding through telepathy, you and other people, scientists and so forth, really breakthrough information, phenomenal information that takes all physics that we have been tethered to and tosses it in the garbage can, right?
Yes.
Why did they bring us along still at a rather deliberate pace? Now, we do know that what I'm saying is partially incorrect, because the Apollo program had nothing to do with what we were really already doing. That was a diversion for the public. So they really did, in some ways, did they not, let us go and give us a tremendous, let's call it a light year in advance. But in public, here we are with the space shuttle, here we are with Apollo and the LEM and all of that. This was horse and buggy stuff compared to what was already going on in a parallel program that you knew about. Is that a fair summation?
Yes, and these were just decoys. All of the rest of this, even the space shuttle, it's a decoy. It's actually quite foolish if you want the truth, because you have people doing things that are way beyond that. It's unbelievable that the public was controlled on this whole
they
way
were,
of life.
They were conned. They were hustled into thinking that this was technology that we all of a sudden had leaped into, and we were able to put men on the moon and all that. As you know, my father was public relations director of McDonnell Douglas, and before that, Douglas Aircraft, and he was there about this time and was there 15 years. And he told me once, he said, Jeff, I asked him about the space shuttle and all that, because they were arguing in the beginning, should they make this hybrid thing, which would be the Saturn V rocket, for example, and take a capsule up, and later on they would use a shuttle attached to an SRB, and that was another hybrid, two types of technology. He said, it's all he said BS, but he didn't say BS. He said it's all bullshit. He said they know way more than that. And he said this is he told me, he said this was a misdirection. And that's all he would say. He would not disclose anything secret, but he said just remember it's all BS. It's not to demean the contributions. It's not to demean the work that was done or the sacrifices made by our Apollo people at all. But he said, never forget that.
Yes, you're right. He was right. There's a one of the pages there talked about interplanetary travel between satellites and different orbits. And they're going into, for instance, missions in this same document. They're attempting to figure out, okay, how is this rocket or this propulsion going to be used? And so they have to step back and figure, well, what kind of a mission is it? Not just how to make a new propulsion, but how is this? What's the mission? How are we going to use this? How do we get out into the galaxy and for commerce with other extraterrestrial intelligence out there? And so you then find that different types of propulsion will operate in different environments, uh-huh, even under different different types of atmosphere, different types of gravity, under different conditions. We're starting to ask all kinds of questions which are related to the different propulsions that the book is talking about.
We also want to remind people, Bill, that NASA, which was entirely a World War II German scientist concern, Dr. Kurt Diebus ran it and all that until 1973, NASA wasn't even brought into being until the middle of 1958, when it was called the National Aeronautics and Space Act, and it became from that NASA. But we didn't even have NASA when this document that we're talking about, that I read from, that Bill provided, and Bill was there, that was 1955. And they're talking about ionic engines and all kinds of things. These are phenomenal things that are being distributed to human beings by the Nordics, by the secretaries. Perfect position for them to hide out in, actually, when you think about it. And they were running the whole thing.
That's amazing, really. Unbelievable. They even have atomic power propulsion that they were developing. And it's interesting that went along, too, for a while. Uh-huh. And then they started realizing, we had the results, of course, of 1946 when we dropped bombs on Japan and did a lot of damage over there, that this may not be a good idea to use it as a propulsion.
No, too dangerous.
Radiation.
Very dangerous.
And dangerous.
Yeah.
And so that's one reason you're going to read about atomic power in here, but almost nobody wanted to play with that. They didn't even want to deal
uh-huh.
with it.
Can't imagine why not.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we didn't slow down, unfortunately, in terms of atomic energy. We went on to ignite scores and scores of atomic bombs, of nuclear bombs, thermonuclear weapons of massive size, most of which went off in the South Pacific, polluting the planet. Those radionuclides are still up in the upper atmosphere, still coming down on us all these years later. And then we split the atom for peace and came up with the most crazy, lunatic idea of it all. And those are atomic power plants with nowhere to dispose.
Never should have done it.
Nowhere
Never
to dispose the spent fuel. No, nothing to do with them. We're stuck with them forever. Just insane. Crazy.
That's absolutely insane. People have no idea what a dumb thing that was to do. We have one of the nuclear power generators right just north of San Diego here, and it's still there. We didn't move it. It's still contaminating the ocean where it is.
Even though it's shut down, ladies and gentlemen, please understand that San Onofre is still dirty. All decommissioned nuclear power plants still dirty and emitting dangerous and deadly radiation.
Yes. It's crazy. And now they've decided that they don't want to move it. They're just going to leave it there and cover it up with some. That's another story entirely.
Yeah. All right.
Another chapter in here is interstellar flight. Now, here we go back again to what is the propulsion going to be used for? Where are we going? It says interstellar flight, okay? And it then defines different types of both commercial and military operations out in the galaxy. So what do you need for this? And all I'm trying to say, you don't just talk about in this document about different ways to push something. You actually then get into what are you going to do with it? What is it all about? What's the mission? What kind of a vehicle is going to be using this? What are the conditions of operating? What's the distance of the and the range of the mission? How far out into the galaxy? So people were starting to ask these questions over and over, and then trying to relate some other method of accomplishing this propulsion. And I think that document is it's really interesting, and I'm so glad you've got it and you're using it on the radio show today.
Well, I'm so glad you gave it to Frank, and I thank Frank for sharing it right away with me, and we'll pursue these. Because what these are, and a lot of you just really love listening to Bill relating his experiences, but what these documents do is completely legitimize everything he says. You've got proof. It's right here. Now, let me ask you, you had a luncheon with Wernher von Braun and two Nordic secretaries. Can you tell us about that story?
Yes. Now, that mission was really where the easiest way to say this is that Douglas had a contract on the Apollo program of designing and building what's called the S-4B stage, which is the top control stage of the Apollo.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So that stage has to control the mission, and it has to have everything set up for the landing and everything else on the landing, and then the return. So our contract from NASA, we didn't have the ability to accomplish what the contract said, because there were so many what-if things that were wrong with the contract that our group, instead of just handling my section, just handling test equipment for everything, okay, it forced us to get into every other possible failure of the vehicle. And then when we got further into it, we found that it forced us to address the entire Apollo vehicle, and then it forced us to address the Apollo missions. So this section that I had went from 40 or 50 people to 170 people, because we then found that they had everything wrong on the launch complex. That then forced everything to be wrong on the capability of checking out, the environment to check it out in. They had a contract for us to, they gave us a contract to build a hangar for our S-4B stage, which had great big hangar doors on both ends of it. The atmosphere down there at the Cape is insane. It's insane. And we have advanced electronics all over our vehicle. So I said, we're not doing that. First of all, we're not checking it out in a horizontal position because the Germans have had problems with that ever since the V2. When you erect it to a vertical position, things change. So I said, we want a vertical assembly building for our stage. And then because we turned out to be the systems people on the Apollo program, we're sticking our nose into everybody's business, and they're wrong. So actually, the Germans had, when they came over, they're brilliant, but they had a lot of hang-ups. They wanted to launch, have the launch control in a concrete blockhouse underneath the ground, real deep down, with a periscope.
That was their mentality from the war, yeah.
Absolutely. So I said, no way. And I had already designed a massive launch complex for the Air Force, which is the Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha, Nebraska, which is 400 feet underneath the ground and checks everything out there in space. Okay? So I took that same design, I put it into an unsolicited proposal, along with completely changing everything for checkout and launch, and designed the vertical assembly building and put that into our package. And so we came up with that, and then to demonstrate it, I had a large 6-foot by 6-foot model built of this launch complex instead of the underground things that the Germans had. Mm-hmm. And you've seen the photographs. Every time you saw a launch, you saw that launch control center. But we had four major things that had to be completely redone on the Apollo program, or it wasn't going to work.
Wow.
So I took this and I put the model on a DC-7, brand new one, Douglas, and flew it down to the NASA facilities. And I didn't have a way to get that great big box, 6 foot by 6 foot by 2 feet, in there. So, and remember, it's a big gray box.
Right.
So I rented a truck. There wasn't a closed truck available, so I had to take one where the sides show. You've seen, everybody's seen trucks like that.
Sure.
And you put the different sides on. So you put the model on that. We tie it down. And then again, it was a whole bunch of different gears, and I'd never driven it. And never driven a truck. And I had a three-piece business suit, and the man that I rented it from said, you better have somebody drive that for you. And I said, well, no, I can make it. And he said, have you ever done it before? And I said, no, but it'll work. And I did grind the gears several times. But the interesting thing is that you talk about the nice Nordic secretaries. Before I left to go to the Redstone Arsenal, which was NASA's office facilities, and laboratories. Actually, my secretary told me that I've typed up an introduction for you.
Dr. Debus.
To Dr. Debus, an introduction to Von Braun and Dr. Debus, but you're never going to need it. And I said, okay, because she said, you know, she'll fix things. So it's important for what some people will take the time to read that book called the gosh. The book is my book is a far 5-star book sales book. Probably the most sold book on this subject, period.
You're talking about Chosen by Extraterrestrials?
Yeah, and in that
Bill's book,
I write about this truck that I rented. Mm-hmm. I wrote about the model. And what I'm trying to say is that I actually had them put the model on this truck, and I drove it through town. And remember, I'm trying to get to the base, which is one of the highest classified bases in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get to Von Braun's tower, his building there. So I'm driving towards the gate. Now, instead of turning off to the right and parking the truck and then going in and getting all of my secret documents cleared and who I'm going to talk to,
yes,
which I didn't have any of that.
Yes.
She told me the gate's going to open. Just keep driving, Bill. So I do. I keep driving, and when I got close to the gate, it was wide open. I drove right in.
Were there guards there, Bill?
There were 4 guards there.
Uh-huh.
Nobody grabbed the rifles and started shooting. Nothing came after me, okay? I drove in there, and I got into the base, which is covered with trees, so you can't see any tall building at all. And it's almost like driving in town with big trucks going back and forth, military vehicles continual. And I'm in a business suit with a driving a truck and no license. Anyway, I get to Von Braun's building, and there's a lot of steps that go up from where you can park. So I parked it right in front of the building, not in the proper parking area. 4 fellas, security guards, put their rifles against the wall in the security area, opened up the doors, and came down. They had a 4-wheel dolly that they were carrying down the steps, and they carried this down over to that truck. They never said a word. They took off the side a wooden guards to keep everything from falling off of the truck.
Yeah, the side panels, sure.
The side panels. They put this on a dolly. Who told them to have a dolly there? That big of a dolly. Okay? Nobody says a word.
Yeah, that was your secretary arranged, just like she said, she arranged it all.
But you have to ask the question, how did she do all of this?
Well, it wasn't over the telephone, was it, Bill?
No, it was not. So, don't discount some of these absolutely unbelievable things that have happened to different people on this whole program. Okay.
Yeah. Bill, we have to pause. Hold that. That's a perfect place to pause. The book is Selected by Extraterrestrials, My Life in the Top Secret World of UFOs, Think Tanks, and Nordic Secretaries. Selected by Extraterrestrials. You can click on Bill's name and go right to the Amazon page. Get yourself a copy. You've never read anything like it. And these on-air interviews with Bill are just amazing to listen to. We will be right back with another hour, so don't go away.